In our study of the book of Ruth, we have been following this compelling story through lots of twists and turns. Elimelech had taken his family to Moab because there was a famine in Israel. He had two sons. It's only a temporary measure, but then he died shortly after they arrived in Moab, and these two sons married Moabite women. 10 years go by, and the two sons died. There weren't any children to those marriages, and so after 10 years of life being upset and changed by things nobody would ever have expected, there are in Moab three widows, two different generations, but three widows. And then word comes that God has provided bread in the house of bread, which is what the word Bethlehem means. God had given bread. The famine was over. And Naomi heads back, and these two daughters-in-law came back with her, and along the way, she gave that count the cost speech to the daughters-in-law. She said, you need to think about what you're doing. It's going to be hard for you. I'm not going to be able to find husbands for you. Go back home to your gods. Go back home to your families. She said that knowing that if they would go back, then they didn't believe what she believed. And better to go now than to go later when it's harder. Orpah took her up on that advice. She never really believed in the God that Naomi believed in, and so she went home to her false gods, to her comfortable religion, to her family that had taught her in that and that would accept her as long as she was in that. She went home. She walked away from the light that she had seen and went back to the darkness where it was more comfortable. But at that same advice, and even more intense count-the-cost kind of advice, Ruth instead made a very profound, very insightful statement of faith and made a commitment to stay with Naomi in Israel where the true God was worshipped for life. She's never going back. I'm with you. Quit talking like this. I believe in this God. I'm never leaving Israel again. I'll die here. It's a beautiful testimony of faith. And so they come back to Bethlehem, very impoverished widows, one older, one younger. They have nothing. They have nothing to fall back on. It's all been used up in 10 years of hardship. And so Ruth goes out, being the one with the strength to do it, to pick up the leavings behind the harvesters as they began the first really significant harvest since the famine started, which would have been more than 10 years before. You don't know it's bad the first year. You don't really call it a famine until some time has gone by. And you don't move away until some more time has gone by and you're desperate. And so more than a decade since they'd had a good harvest. They had a provision for the poor and needy and for the foreigner that they went over their fields once. This was from God's law in Leviticus. You go over your field once. If you miss anything, you leave it for the poor people, and they can come into your field, and they can gather behind the harvesters and get whatever's left. And if you drop something, you don't go back and pick it up. You let them pick that up too. It was a way of providing for them. It's to teach people not to be stingy, but to be generous. Not to be worried about that little bit more that isn't going to make a difference to you, but to leave it for the people who are needy, who are willing to come and do the work to get it. And Ruth, having no other options, says, I'm going to go and do that. And Naomi says, good idea. And so she goes out, and she happens, in God's providence, to wind up in a field belonging to a man named Boaz, who is very kind to her and very generous. He knows who she is. When he hears who she is, he remembers that he's heard about her. He knows who she is. He has to know that's her, but he knows the story. And so he decides to be generous. He feeds her a meal, and she has leftovers. And he arranges for his staff to make sure that they accidentally drop some every now and then so that she can get enough, for not just for herself, but for Naomi too. These are real lives. These were really hard things that they went through. The story is riveting. It has so many dynamics that inform us about life, that help us know how to face things, that work on our sensibilities and make us go, wow, what a story. These are lives that have been changed by God. Naomi and Ruth and Boaz. have been changed from the inside out. They're really believers. It shows up when they're under pressure. They trusted God to deal with their sin. They were saved in exactly the same way people are saved today. They looked to God to do all of the work, 100% of the work. They didn't know how it would be. They didn't know His name would be Jesus. They didn't know He would die on a cross to shed His blood as a substitutionary sacrifice for their sins. But they knew that God would make the sacrifice, that God had to make the payment for their sins because they knew they couldn't. And they ran to Him in faith and trusted Him, and they were saved, just like we're saved now by looking back at the cross. Faith alone, in God's provision alone, by grace alone, and no part of our work, no part of our intelligence, no part of our helping out or sprucing ourselves up first. It's just grace, and they got that, and they were saved, and they were changed. And just that example that we've already seen over and over again in this study is a tremendous challenge. When you see a righteous life bearing up under pressure, it encourages and challenges you. This book does all of that. But this book does a lot more than that. A lot more. And in today's text, we're going to see something of the bigger picture of the book of Ruth, because now we're going to start getting a glimpse of the Redeemer as pictured and foreshadowed in this book. Our text is Ruth chapter 2, beginning with verse 17. We'll read through chapter 3, verse 5. Ruth 2:17. I'll give you a second to get there. The reference, the pronoun here is referring to Ruth. We're picking up where we left off last week. It says, "So she gleaned in the field until evening. Then she beat out what she had gleaned, and it was about an ephah of barley. She took it up and went into the city, and her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned. She also took it out and gave Naomi what she had left after she had been satisfied." That's referring to the meal she had eaten. Verse 19. "Her mother-in-law then said to her, 'Where did you glean today, and where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed.' So she told her mother-in-law with whom she had worked and said, 'The name of the man with whom I work today is Boaz.' Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, 'May he be blessed of the Lord, who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and to the dead.' Again, Naomi said to her, 'The man is our relative. He is one of our closest relatives.' Then Ruth, the Moabitess, said, 'Furthermore, he said to me, "You should stay close to my servants until they have finished all my harvest."' Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, 'It is good, my daughter, that you go out with his maids, so that others do not fall upon you in another field.' So she stayed close by the maids of Boaz in order to glean until the end of the barley harvest and the end of the wheat harvest. And she lived with her mother-in-law. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maids you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. It shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do.' She said to her, 'All that you say, I will do.'" After Boaz was so kind to Ruth, she continued to work until evening. That first verse we said indicated that. She didn't go home early because she had enough. She didn't go home early because he had fed her. She didn't assume he would feed her every day. She thought past the day, and so she kept working, even though she had to be tired. It's a long day if you work in the field until it gets too dark to work. That's a long day. But she went there, and she stayed there, and she kept working, and then she went home. She beat out the grain so that she wouldn't have to carry the stalks. She just separated it, you know. So she just had the barley, the heads of barley, the grain itself, put all that up in a sack or whatever she had to carry it in, wrapped it up in a shawl or something, and headed for home. When she got all of the stuff you don't eat removed, she found that she had an ephah of barley. This is a measure equal to just a little more than half a bushel. This is between 30 and 40 pounds of barley. If you had a 5-gallon bucket, this would fill it to the brim. This was about all she might be able to carry home. We don't know how strong she was, but that's a pretty good load if you're walking far and you don't have a way to distribute it comfortably. She had a good day. When she got home, Naomi saw what she had gathered and the leftovers that Ruth gave her from the meal, so that Naomi then had a meal. It was enough for two of them. And Naomi knew immediately that someone had been generous. You know, you see this, you're just picking up what they missed, right? You don't expect to get much, so you see this load and you know somebody's been really nice today. This is more than anyone could expect to pick up from the leavings. And so in verse 19, it says, her mother-in-law then said to her, "Where did you glean today and where did you work? May he who took notice of you be blessed." She doesn't have to ask. She knows. Somebody stepped in. And I want you to notice that this righteous woman prays for this person's blessing without having any idea who he is. She just knows that no one owed them this and that this is generosity, and she's grateful for it. And she's wishing God's blessing on one who has met such a critical need in her life and Ruth's life. I have found over the years, particularly when I began to be on the receiving end in a church, that giving and receiving can be an awkward business. You know, being the person people give to, if there's any pride in your heart, it comes up with that. And sometimes the giver has a pride issue too, and they don't really give it. They're buying a service or they're buying a position or something. But when everyone is humble and selfless, when the receiver will humble himself and the giver will humble himself, then giving and receiving is a right part of how we're to live in this world under God's care. And Naomi knew how to receive. She had already learned to humble herself. You do have to do that. If you get into a position where you just can't get by and someone gives to you, the first time that ever happened, I had to go pray because I thought I should have earned that in a different way. And once I prayed and dealt with it, I recognized that I'm just being prideful. God has provided for me, and who am I to say? It never bothered me when I was the one giving it. I thought it was a privilege to give it to a Christian who was in need, but when it was me that needed it, it was hard at first. But she's dealt with that. And so immediately she said, "May he be blessed who did this." And then when she does know who it is and that he's a close relative, she doesn't go, "Oh, well, he should have. I mean, after all, he's got plenty and he's our kinfolk. He should have done it." No, she doesn't think even Boaz owes this to her, and so she continues to express gratitude. In fact, she adds to it. In verse 20, it says, "Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, may he be blessed of the Lord." Well, I'm sorry. Verse 21. No, she says, "The man is a close relative of ours. He's one of our closest relatives. May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and the dead." There it is. Finally found it. Right where I thought it was and quit looking. "May he be blessed of the Lord who has not withdrawn his kindness to the living and the dead." So instead of saying, "Well, he should have," Naomi is ready to say, telling Ruth, "This guy has always been this way. When Elimelech and Mahlon and Chilion were alive more than 10 years ago and in town, this guy was being kind to them." You know, the only way you can be kind to the dead is to get it done before they're dead, right? They weren't trying to pray anybody out of purgatory. This isn't what that means. She means this guy has got a history of being kind to us when we have needed it that lasts more than a decade. We don't know how much more, but more. And she's grateful. And she remembers the kindness because that's how she views it. Now it is in verse 20 that we get our first glimpse of something much, much bigger than the lives of the people that are in this book. It says at the end of that verse, "Again, Naomi said to her, 'The man is our relative. He is one of our closest relatives.'" More literally, what she said is, "The man is near to us. He is one of our redeemers." That word is literally redeemer at the end, not relative. Plural, redeemers. Naomi is referring to a system that was also set up in the law that God gave to Moses to make provision for people whose lives have been overtaken by circumstances and who cannot get out of the mess that they're in. A person who was a close relative had a right and a responsibility to intervene for his family member in certain situations and to fix that family member's problem at his own expense. Like if you were the one with the money, you did it at your cost to bail out the close relative who was in a mess. When a family member exercised that right and responsibility, he was called a kinsman redeemer. And because Boaz was a close relative, Naomi refers to him as one of the potential redeemers. He's one of the ones who has the right and the responsibility to step in if somebody in her family is in trouble. As a relative of Elimelech, he had the right to intervene for the family of Elimelech or the family of the son, Machlon, who had been married to Ruth before he died. Now, the kinsman redeemer could intervene in three specific ways. The first one involved land. If an Israelite lost his family inheritance through financial disaster, then the close relative had a right and a responsibility to step in, if he had the money, and buy back this inheritance that had been lost, this family land that had been lost, and give it to the guy who had inherited it. To step in and buy it back from the bank and give it to the guy free and clear. A relative who could afford to do it would do it. Look at Leviticus chapter 25, beginning with verse 47. Leviticus 25, 47. It says, Leviticus 25, 23 first. It says, "The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine. For you are but aliens and sojourners with me." This is God speaking. "Thus for every piece of your property you are to provide for the redemption of the land. If a fellow countryman of yours becomes so poor that he has to sell part of his property, then his nearest kinsman is to come and buy back what his relative has sold, or in case a man has no kinsman, but so recovers his means as to find sufficient for its redemption, then he shall calculate the years since the sale and refund the balance to the man to whom he had sold it, and so return to his property. But if he has not found sufficient means to get it back for himself, then what he has sold shall remain in the hands of the purchaser until the year of Jubilee. But at the Jubilee it shall revert so that he may return to his property." So in a financial situation that had gotten so bad that someone loses their farm and has to sell to a foreigner, then the relative would step in, buy it back, and give it to them, put them back on their land. The second opportunity for the kinsman to step in and redeem the property or redeem something involves the issue of slavery. And this is the one in Leviticus 25:47. Look at that. This is if it gets even worse and now you've lost more than your land. Now, if the means of a stranger or a sojourner with you become sufficient, and a countryman of yours becomes so poor with regard to him as to sell himself to a stranger who is sojourning with you, or to the descendants of a stranger's family, then he shall have redemption right after he has been sold. One of his brothers may redeem him, or his uncle's son may redeem him, or one of his blood relatives from his family may redeem him, or if he prospers, he may redeem himself. So nobody was to remain a slave. If a brother or an uncle or a cousin had the means, then you stepped in and you bought them back out of slavery, even if their own bad decisions had put them there. At your cost, you bought them. We're not talking about a little bit of money here either. You gave them their freedom. The kinsman redeemer footed the cost. The person in trouble received the benefit. The third opportunity and responsibility for redemption involves the family lineage. If a married man died before he had children, his closest eligible relative was to marry the widow. And the first son, if God provided one, from that union belonged to the deceased husband and carried his name and inherited his property. And then after that, the brother or the cousin would raise up if there was another child. That one would belong to the redeemer. But the first one wasn't even counted as his. It was for the dead brother, the dead relative. Now keep Leviticus 25 marked if you want to, because we're going to come back to that in a minute. And look at Deuteronomy 25, verse 5. Deuteronomy 25, beginning with verse 5. When a man takes a... That's the wrong chapter. When brothers live together and one of them dies and has no son, the wife of the deceased shall not marry outside the family to a strange man. Her husband's brother shall go into her and take her to himself as wife and perform the duty of a husband's brother to her. It shall be that the firstborn whom she bears shall assume the name of his dead brother, so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. But if a man does not desire to take his brother's wife, then his brother's wife shall go up to the gate to the elders of the city and say, "My husband's brother refuses to establish a name for his brother in Israel. He is not willing to perform the duty of a husband's brother to me." Then the elders of his city shall summon him and speak to him. And if he persists and says, "I do not desire to take her," then his brother's wife shall come to him in the sight of the elders and pull his sandal off his foot and spit in his face. And she shall declare, "Thus it is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. In Israel, his name shall be called the house of him whose sandal is removed." It's a little different from our contracts, but you get the feel. You kind of know what this is when you read that. The man had to be willing. In the case of this issue with lineage, as with the others, he had to be willing. If he wasn't willing, he could refuse. He had that option. It was considered a breach of responsibility, but he could refuse. And the passage in Deuteronomy also makes something else very clear. The woman was to express her desire to be redeemed. She's the one driving this thing where the shoe comes off and the spit starts flying, right? The woman, not the man. She's driving this. She has a right to ask. And it may well have been that she had to ask. But she certainly could have. If the guy didn't desire, he's not going to ask, right? So she's to ask. And then she has the right to press him publicly if he hesitates. "I'm going to sick the elders on you, man." And then, if he still just isn't willing, the rest of that stuff, which is just really interesting. Now, all of this, not just the spit and the sandal, all of this is really different from the way we do things. And so it might be helpful to think for a minute about why this is here and what this means, this kinsman-redeemer system. Obviously, we could say that this system was good for the people of God. If you were forced off of your land, if you were forced into slavery, if you were a widow left behind without children in a system where your children supported you in your old age, God had provided a way for your life to return to a sense of normalcy, for you to be redeemed out of that terrible situation that you had fallen into, maybe even by your own choices. There was still a way for you to be redeemed and be restored to a kind of good times again. This provision on the part of God demonstrates the value of the individual to God. Individual people are important to Him. It shows that He has concern for the poor and the hurting, something that comes up a lot in the Bible. He has concern for the bereaved. He has concern for those who have been overtaken by circumstances and even for those who have been overtaken by their own foolishness so that they have lost everything and maybe even lost their freedom through bad decisions. In the case of the man who dies without children, it gives a way for his lineage to be preserved, showing that his life is important in this economy that God has set up. The system also demonstrates the importance of the relationships that God has given us in His sovereign working in our lives. This is something that has become clear to me in a new way in the last year as our family has grown so much closer to Sharon's sister and her family. We've been thrown together as Sharon's dad was terminally ill earlier in the year. And we're closer now than we have ever been, and I cherish those relationships like I never had opportunity before. These relationships are within God's providence in your life. And this system demonstrates that God has a purpose in the people He brings into your life through things that you haven't even thought of and things you can't control. Nobody picks father or mother. Nobody picks brothers and sisters. You get what you get. And what you get is what God gave you. He picked them. Now, we have very specific commands in Scripture regarding how we are to treat people within these relationships. Fathers, do not exasperate your children, but instruct them in the Lord. One of the Ten Commandments, honor your father and your mother, which Ephesians says is the first commandment with a promise, that it may be well with you and that you may live long in the land. In the case of the kinsman redeemer, only a close relative had the right to do this. You couldn't do this just because you liked somebody, even if you were that generous. It wasn't going to be acknowledged in the system. Only the relatives had this right. The widow has no control over who the brothers are or whether any of them are available or who the cousins might be or who the closest eligible bachelor even is or whether she thinks she's going to like him. I can tell you that she didn't set out to marry any of them when she said yes to her husband. And yet God is sovereign in these family relationships, and they are important. They have value in our lives. Consider your in-laws to be a blessing from the Lord and an opportunity from the Lord and a responsibility from the Lord, and your brothers and your sisters and your parents and your children, your grandchildren. Those are just a few things that I got out of why. But in Leviticus 25, there is one that is explicitly stated, if you want to turn back to that now. Leviticus 25, 55, the last verse of that chapter, contains a purpose statement regarding this system that has just been conveyed, this kinsman-redeemer system. Why in the world are we going to do it this way? Verse 55 says, God speaking, "For the sons of Israel are my servants. They are my servants, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God." Why are we going to do it this way? Because God is God and you are not. That's what that verse is saying. This system existed in Israel because God set it up this way, and He's God. He has ownership of the lives of every person He has created. He is the owner He has the rights of ownership. And this system demonstrates that he has those rights. That he has rights to give commands, rights to put people where he chooses to put them, into the family he chooses, with the opportunity he chooses, with the blessings he gives, and without the blessings he doesn't give. God is God. That's an important reason. But I think perhaps the most important reason for this kinsman-redeemer system was one of those things that only gradually came to light in the progressive revelation of God. Through this system, God was demonstrating his willingness to redeem the helpless, to intervene at his own expense on behalf of those who could not help themselves. This system is a foreshadowing of the work of Jesus Christ on the cross to redeem for himself, at his cost, all who would believe his gospel. Because we are made in the image of our Creator, we have a close kinsman relationship, and he has every right to redeem us if he chooses. On the cross, Jesus intervened at his own expense. He paid the price for our sins, though it was our own foolishness that took us there, and we were completely helpless there. He bore the cost. He paid the price. He rescued us from the slavery of sin. He restored us to the inheritance of the saints in heaven that we had forsaken through our own rebellion. He brought us back to the rights of our inheritance in heaven. We were absolutely helpless. We could do nothing to free ourselves from the mess we had made of our own lives. We had made ourselves enemies of God by our own actions, by our own corruption in the heart. And Jesus Christ stepped in as Redeemer and paid the full price himself, bore the whole cost, and gave freedom to everyone who would believe. In the ancient laws of Israel, God established a system that would show what he had decided to do from before the foundations of the world. Only a glimpse that over time came to light in the glorious revelation of Jesus Christ himself. This little picture in Leviticus and Deuteronomy and then demonstrated in Ruth shows us the heart of Almighty God to redeem the helpless. It even shows that the one needing to be rescued should come and ask with confidence. Now, this system that is so strange to us was just part of life for an Israelite. This was just part of the mindset. They all knew about this. This was just, all you had to do was mention it. It was even a custom in many of the countries surrounding Israel, so it wouldn't have been brand new to Ruth either. So this system was what was in Naomi's mind when she said to Ruth, "This man is near to us. He is one of our redeemers." Both of them would have known immediately all of that stuff that I just told you in great detail. It would have come to mind just like that because they knew this stuff. Boaz has the right to step in at his own cost and raise up an heir for Macklin who had died. He can, if he's willing, marry this widow, raise up a child for the dead husband, and then other children for himself if God should give them. That's what's in the ladies' minds now. Girls, they're planning a wedding. That's going to be fun, isn't it? The girls all smile. Well, even in this system, you don't get married on a whim. She barely knows this man. She met him that day. And so in the meantime, Naomi says, it's a very good idea for you to stay with his maids because he'll provide protection and nobody will hurt you in another field. It's not a safe place to be a foreigner, just like anywhere else. Ladies have to be careful, just like now. Stay with his maids. That's a good idea. And so she does. And so she stays there and works wherever they happen to be working, in the fields that belong to Boaz throughout the rest of the barley harvest and through all of the wheat harvest. Now, these would have been jammed right up against each other. This would have been a period of about 2 months' time of really intense work, long, hard days, getting it while we can get it in before it can ruin for about a couple of months. First the barley harvest and then the wheat harvest. Long days and close proximity. You're going to see Boaz a lot if you stay with his maids. And then at the end of that time, roughly 2 months, Naomi announces a plan. Girls, she's planning a wedding. She announces a plan that involves this kinsman redeemer system. Look at chapter 3 of Ruth, beginning with verse 1. Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman with whose maid you were? Behold, he winnows barley at the threshing floor tonight. Wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. But do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and drinking. It shall be when he lies down that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do." She said to her, "All that you say, I will do." Naomi is still thinking of others. She says, "Shouldn't I look for what's best for you? The harvest is done. The opportunity to spend time with Boaz is about gone, but he's going to be at the threshing floor tonight. This is a place where you can approach him without making a big public display that would embarrass him if he's not willing, without bringing this thing to a head to put pressure on him. This is one of the few opportunities to approach Boaz privately, because after things settle down, then you can get to him without having to make announcements to his servants about what you're up to." And so the plan is for Ruth to make the most of her appearance, put on her nice clothes, get herself all prettied up, and go where Boaz is going to be and wait until she can get to him without anybody else noticing, so there's no pressure, no manipulation, no having to explain this to the people that are, you know, the ones that keep folks away from the rich guy. And then she's going to ask him to marry her, to care for her needs, to raise up an heir for Macklin, to be her husband and her protector. In verse 4, it says, "When he lies down, you will notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what to do." Now, that doesn't make any sense to you and me, unless you've already studied this before now. But to them, this was the whole explanation. This is a marriage proposal. This was an ancient custom in that time, all around that place, including Israel. Uncover his feet and lay down. It means that I need you to, I want to be under you. I want you to protect me, spread your covering over me. Let's get married. That's what it means. Everyone in that culture would have known it was that and nothing more than that. It was not an invitation to any form of wickedness. It was not overly forward. It was not anything but the way they did it. "Will you marry me?" We dropped to one knee. They did it this way, if the lady was doing the asking, which she could do in this system. So Naomi, after the 2 months has gone by, you know, seeing Boaz a lot every day, but it looks like, you know, the harvest is done. We probably won't cross paths with him very often. But tonight, he's going to be down there finishing things up. And he'll sleep there to guard that pile of wheat, because anybody would. He's not going home where you couldn't get to him. The time is right, girl. Dress up to look pretty and go ask this man to marry you. And Ruth says, "All that you say, I will do." Which, being translated, means, "That's a good idea. I believe I'll ask him." You know, you got to kind of put it into your own culture. So you, okay, I'm with it now. So Ruth is going to go and ask this man to step into the role of kinsman redeemer to rescue her life out of this difficulty that she has been facing, to raise up an heir for her husband at his cost, to bless her, to bless the lineage, to provide the lineage of this man who has died. Now, if you bring a Victorian perspective to your study of the scripture, you may think that this is really, really forward and the woman shouldn't be doing this at all, and she shouldn't ask, she should wait. But the fact is, this is a noble trait in Ruth, because this is how it worked. She was in need. She was supposed to make it known if this is what she wanted. She did it in such a way that if he said no, she wasn't going to need to spit in his face. She was being very subtle, no manipulation. But God made specific provision for the specific situation that she was in, and Ruth was going to step up and say, I want that provision that God has made for me. I want that to be fulfilled in my life, and that was a good thing for her to do. Ruth is willing and ready to press for the fulfillment of what God has provided because she believes in God's provision, and she's going to trust to Boaz to take it from there. That's what Naomi said. He'll tell you what to do. All you're going to do is make known your desire, and he'll tell you what to do. He might say, no, I don't think so. I can't marry a foreigner. That would just be disgusting to me. Or, no, I don't want to do that. I'm going to raise up my own son. I'm still looking. But he'll tell you what to do. All you're going to do is make known. Now, this aspect of Ruth's doing this herself and asking him is also a good picture of the ultimate redeemer. Because God has made the provision in Jesus Christ. God has paid the full price for sins for all who believe. And if by his grace you are enabled to understand the beauty of what he has done, and if you believe it, then you will approach him. You will. We don't do a whole lot of trying to drag you down an aisle here or trying to talk you into accepting something, because we know that if you believe this, you'll step up. You don't need an aisle to do it. You'll go to Jesus and you'll ask. You will. If you believe this gospel, you'll ask him to apply it to your heart. You'll run to him because you'll know he's your only hope. And nobody will ever have to nudge you when it's real. And by not nudging people, we don't get as many false converts. When you believe this, you'll ask him. When you know how desperate you are and you recognize that you have a redeemer, you'll go to him. Now, some of you here today need to do that. You've been telling yourself all kinds of reasons why. You know what Jesus did, but you got a reason not to do anything about it. Know that his blood was sufficient, but you're holding back out of some foolish pride or something else. You've not ever humbled yourself and asked him to save you, and you must do so. And when you believe him, you will do so. When you trust his provision, when you trust his character, you'll come to him and ask. Cry out to this Savior and be saved. He will not turn you away. He cares for the hurting. He has made provision for the desperate. Now, the rest of us, from this glimpse of the Redeemer in Ruth, ought to find new material for rejoicing in the goodness of our Savior. This ought to enhance our worship of him. We should be encouraged and strengthened as we meditate on how God did this from before the foundations of the world. He knew our need. He provided for us. He cared for us when there was nothing good about us. Let me lead us in prayer.